Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz, and joining me, as always, is Clinton Matos.
That's once again me. Hello, everybody.
And Robin Lichetti.
Howdy.
Guys, looking forward to the weekend?
Not if it's as cold. Something happened with my water midway through my shower last night. The hot water turned off and I needed to finish my shower with cold water. So it was awful. I thought I was going to freeze to death.
Thoughts and prayers. Robin, yeah. You looking forward to the weekend?
Kind of. My mother's birthday, so probably do some celebrations of some kind. But the riots at the moment aren't exactly helping my current state of mind, so yeah.
In slightly better news, if you are between the ages of 35 and 50, I'm very jealous of you for the first time in my life, but you can now register to go and get your vaccines if you didn't know. Seeing lots of social media posts about folks getting their jabs, so if you are able to register, please go and register. The sooner we get through the vast majority of the 35 to 50-year-olds, the sooner the rest of us can go and get vaccinated. So please do that. We would encourage you to go and get your COVID-19 vaccine.
I want my jab, damn it.
Yeah, so do I, dude. I'm really, really upset seeing all these like posts about people getting their vaccination. And I'm just sitting here like, if only I was born a bit later. Shakes my fist at the heavens. All right, let's dive into the news of the week. And I'm going to kick us off with Apple's app tracking transparency. Do you guys know what that is?
I assume they have.
I know something about it, too.
Yeah, so earlier this year with iOS 14.5, Apple kind of put an arrow to the knee of advertisers through something called app tracking transparency. So essentially now, whenever you install an application on your iPhone, it's going to prompt you and ask whether you want other applications or whether you want this application to be able to share data about what you're doing, what other applications you use, what websites you visit, that sort of stuff, right? And while previously app developers and publishers of applications used this data to kind of serve you more relevant advertising, right? So instead of getting generic ads for dog food for your pets, you might get an advert that is dog food specifically for your type of dog, okay? So these apps would follow you around and take all the data, and Apple kind of put a stop to that with app tracking transparency. So essentially, you, the user, can opt in to applications using this data, or you can opt out. And apparently, only 20% of users are allowing apps to personalize their ads by allowing the app to track them when presented with the ATT prompts. This is from Brian Bauman, who works for Consumer Acquisition, who this week published a blog going through how ATT, or app tracking transparency, is hurting the industry in a manner of speaking. And when I say hurting, it's essentially making advertisers and marketers work a bit harder in terms of advertising, because now they don't have this data, from iPhones at least, to leverage and hoover up and use to serve you more relevant advertising. Instead, now they have to kind of make adverts that appeal to a certain type of audience. And Consumer Acquisition goes through a whole bunch of graphs showing how the data that advertisers can leverage now has completely disappeared, and how this is creating a bit of a problem. But I find it really humorous, not funny, but it gives me a bit of a chuckle to see how this company, Consumer Acquisition, has kind of framed this, you know, saying that, oh, well, you know, Apple is really bad to have done this. For instance, there's one here that says, during an interview with VentureBeat, Bauman said, Apple has done a phenomenal job of PR. They don't offer privacy. What they're doing is centralizing and curating data. You have to use their app store. You have to use their payment gateway. They understand your voice, your fingerprints, and your health data. They understand where you purchase. That's not privacy. Apple is defining privacy by saying they get all of the data and therefore it's private. It's absurd, says Bauman. So while I tend to agree with what he says in the sense that Apple does have access to all this data that you give them, I would also say that Apple has a responsibility to guard that data from their customers and not sell it to any Tom, Dick, and Harry that comes along looking for it, no matter how good their advertising pitch is. The other side of that is that with Apple, they have a bit of a reputation that they need to maintain, right? And if Apple all of a sudden is starting to sell data of its users to other consumers, people are going to speak up about that. So I kind of get what Bowman is saying, but I also don't think what's curious to me is that nowhere in their blog do they point out that users made this choice, and clearly users don't want applications following them around the web. And I just find that really humorous, because at the end of the day, it is the end user that is deciding whether or not they want this relevant advertising or not. There were words used like, customers are delighted by relevant advertising. I've never felt delighted about seeing a relevant ad in my life. They also use examples like using Netflix and Amazon, which curate what you are looking for and give you a better recommendations, which is all good and well, but that's the point of those platforms. I mean, like, I want Netflix to be able to tell me what they think I would enjoy watching based off of past history. But if Netflix was saying, oh, you should definitely watch this after looking at what you're watching on YouTube, I'd have something to say about that. So, yeah, I'll link to the story at the bottom of this post as always. But it's a really interesting read and kind of a disconnect between or kind of interesting to see the disconnect between marketers and end users, and how there's just this missing middle where marketers think that it's Apple's fault for introducing this in the first place, and users are like, this is a great feature, more of this, please, to the point where I think even Google is toying with the idea of introducing a similar sort of thing to Android. So yeah, we'll have a link to the full story at the bottom of this post, as always. Clinton, what have you got for us this week?
We've got something that, depending on how you look at it, more overall positive. I don't think there's any two sides to what we're going to talk about here, as opposed to that advertising stuff. Basically, Valve is making a handheld gaming PC, which is not unexpected because there were a lot of rumors, but it is very good to see, and I'll get to why in a minute. So the device is called the Steam Deck, and it's exactly what I described it as. It's a full gaming PC, but it's also a handheld console. Now, this category wasn't created by a Chinese company called GDP, but it was popularized by them. They created a series of consoles, or PCs rather, it's getting a bit blurred now, called the Win. And there's been the Win 1, the Win 2, and the Win 3, and then there's been several other variations. And they also did the same thing. They put a full computer into a handheld, and they marketed it for games, but you could obviously use it for anything else because it was a full PC. And for a long time, people have been wanting a bigger company to do this, because even though GDP was creating decent products, there wasn't, I don't know how to explain this mentality, there wasn't a wave of this happening. And then even though GDP inspired a lot of other companies to kickstart and crowdfund other similar devices, they were kind of no names. And everyone wanted a big company to do it. And now Valve, which isn't the biggest company, but it is a bigger company, has now thrown its hat into the ring with this thing called the Steam Deck. Now, the name is really irritating because there's a popular device by Elgato, however you pronounce it, called the Stream Deck. This is the Steam Deck. There's a difference. And what puts this one apart from the others, aside from it being made by a bigger company, is that it's also, if I'm not mistaken, the most powerful one released so far. It has an AMD Zen 2 APU, which has 4 cores and 8 threads, which is a lot for a portable device. Yeah. And the screen isn't as good as I thought it would be. It's 7 inches, which is pretty good. That's the same size as the new OLED Nintendo Switch. But it's only 800p. It's 1280x800, which is weird. It's a weird aspect ratio. It's not 720p and it's not 1080p. I would have really liked a full 1080p. And it's also a 16x10 aspect ratio, which is weird. I don't know why they didn't just go with 16x9. And it's at least 60 hertz. And it's touch-enabled, 16 gigabytes of RAM. The battery is estimated to be between 2 and 8 hours of use, depending. Yeah, two is a... You know what? That sounds ridiculous, but I mean, if you play even an indie game on the Nintendo Switch, you can only expect 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah, no, I'm not laughing at that. I'm just laughing at the range, 2 to 8 hours. Yeah. I mean, it's a very big range.
It very much depends on what you're doing, how bright the screen is, are you using Wi-Fi at the same time, or have you got the music on? It's a massive range. I mean, it's like laptops. They also have crazy variances. That's a 40-watt-hour battery. It is 669 grams, which is kind of heavy, but we'll get into ergonomics in a second. And the prices vary greatly because they are attached to storage. There's 64 gigabytes, 256 gigabytes, and 512 gigabytes. And they cost $399, $529, and $649, depending on which you choose. And something else that's also interesting here is you aren't just paying for extra storage. As you go up, those storage options, the tech that's running them actually gets faster as well. So you're paying for more storage and faster storage at the same time. But something that's really nice is that every model has a micro SD card slot. So even if you get the base version with slower memory, you can just pop a micro SD card in there. Now for the bad news, not available in South Africa. The launch markets are US, UK, EU, and Canada. So they have said that when this launches in December of this year, in 2022, they'll expand it to more markets. But will South Africa be included? I highly doubt it, because this isn't the first time Valve has made hardware. They made the Steam controller, they made Steam boxes, and they had third parties making Steam boxes. They're still making the Valve Index, the VR headset, and none of that has ever been available in South Africa. So unless this becomes ridiculously popular and they keep making them and they support into the future, I don't think we'll get it in South Africa, but it's very good to see because, like I said, GDP started this and it needed a bigger name to get in on things. And I don't know if you guys remember, but Alienware announced something called the UFO. They showed it off at one of the trade shows a while ago, and we haven't heard anything about it since. Yeah. And for those who didn't read the news, the Alienware UFO was the same thing, a PC that's a handheld that plays games. So I'm very excited about this. I would obviously love to have it in my hands and to play it just to, you know, write a review or a preview or something. It looks really cool. And the last thing I want to mention before I get your feedback and we move on to the next news segment is that the haptic feedback that the Steam controller used and the Steam controller was famous for, they put it in this console as well, which, again, this PC. And it's made the controls look kind of weird. The touchpads for the haptic feedback, they are just below the joysticks, and then you can use them instead of the joysticks. It looks a bit funky, but I think it's cool. Brendan, we were talking about this before the podcast. Yeah. Would you buy one of these if they were available here? Are you interested in this at all?
In a heartbeat. I was when I saw it announced yesterday, I immediately clicked the link and went to go and see if it would become available in South Africa. And then I had the realization, oh, this is Valve that has at most 500 employees in Seattle, Washington. I don't think that it's going to come to South Africa. But yes, absolutely. I would buy one of these in a heartbeat. And not because it's a cool little device. Well, it is a cool little device.
Yeah.
It looks really powerful. But also, it would likely get me to dive into my massive Steam library that I haven't touched, because there are so many games there that I've either tried on, like, racing games or little fighting games, little platformers, things like that, that I've played on PC, but it didn't really finish or didn't really get into. And I think that this would be a great way to go to play those games, right? So, yeah, I'm excited for this. I'm holding every thumb that I have continuously hoping that it comes to South Africa, but I really don't think it will.
Robin, I know you're not a PC gamer at all, but does this interest you?
I wouldn't say I would be an early adopter or something like this, but I would, I guess, kind of wait to see what the reviews are like, what the experiences are like, potentially what kind of titles would be supported on that, and maybe then I would give it a go. Yeah, like I said, I think we've spoken about the Switch quite a bit, and I know we're talking about two different ecosystems here, but if there was something that kind of at least addresses some of the issues that the Switch has without having to kind of bend to the will of Nintendo, I think a lot of people might be interested in something like that.
Yeah, and I just want to bring up the Switch before we go into the last piece of news. But The two things I want to mention about it is that first, I was surprised by how many games I chose to play on the Switch because it's portable, even though I already had the game on PC, and even though the portable, the place I took the portable was just into my lounge to play on the couch instead of on my computer chair. I think, Brendan, if you got a Switch or something, I think you'd have the same experience where, yeah, I have this game on my PC and I can play it at a high frame rate or whatever, but I really just want to sit on the couch and play it instead. Yeah. It sounds like such a small change. And I'm not saying, oh, you must go, you know, walk around in the street and play your games. I'm just saying moving from your computer chair to the couch is such a big change that it makes this hardware worth it. And even though this is more expensive than the Switch in America, I have to wonder what the pricing would be like in South Africa, because the US price compared to the South African price of the Nintendo Switch after conversions, the Switch is more than double the, almost double the price. So if we could get these in South Africa for the US prices, they would actually be around the same price as the Nintendo Switch. Mm. And on top of that, a lot of games cost more than double on the Switch. I mean, I think it was Hades, where in South Africa you can get Hades for like 150 Rand, and then on the Steam eShop it's 450 or more than that. So there's a big difference where you can get a lot of that money back because you don't have to pay the Switch premium. You don't have to pay 1,200 Rand for a brand new game. So yeah. I've talked a lot about it because I'm very excited about this. I just hope we can get it.
Cool. Robin, you've got some news about smartphone manufacturers and a surprising entry.
So research firm Canalys, I'm not too sure how they like to pronounce it.
I say Canalysis because I'm pretty sure that's how they want people to say it.
Okay, I mean, I'm not a master of pronunciation, but this research firm released the smartphone vendor report for Q2 of 2021. And it was of particular interest to us, not only because we review a lot of smartphones on the site, but also we've been kind of tracking the trajectory of certain Chinese smartphone makers in the industry for the past few years. And a really, I guess, kind of two takeaways from this report is one, that Huawei has dropped out of the top five as far as smartphone shipments go for Q2 2021. And the other is that Xiaomi has overtaken Apple and claimed the second spot in this report. So I think first we should touch on kind of what's happening with Huawei. We know that they have been embattled ever since they were put on the Entity List by the Trump administration. So them dropping out of the top five is not that surprising. That said, it seems like those kind of podcasts have been dedicated towards discussing the future of the company, kind of where its business operations was going to be going moving forward. Those kind of conversations are starting to show out as far as market share goes now, specifically within the smartphone space. If we look at now how Xiaomi is done, so if you the report says that obviously Samsung leads the way with 90% market share and a growth of roughly 15%. And then Xiaomi, out of nowhere, came with a growth of 83% in this quarter. And they have market share now of 70%. So they are within touching distance of Samsung, which has always held the, I guess, the smartphone vendor crown, regardless of what report you're looking at. They've always been number one, and they're kind of always leading the pack. As far as Apple goes, they're sitting at 14%. They only had a growth of 1%. So that kind of shows you that interest in Apple products at the moment is waning a bit. And then we'll touch on two of the other Chinese smartphone vendors. That's Oppo and Vivo, that came in fourth and fifth respectively, each with 10% market share. The growth was also similar. Oppo at 28%, Vivo at 27%. So very similar numbers from those two. And it looks like the quote-unquote smaller Chinese smartphone vendors are now starting to really grow as a result of, one, I think Huawei dropping out of the race as far as its ability to operate. And also, two, their strategy seems to be bearing fruit. So what Canalys was able to tell us is that shipments for Xiaomi increased rapidly, as we saw in the figure of 83%. But specifically in markets like Latin America, it saw an increase of more than 300%. In Africa, 150%. In Western Europe, 50%, so not so much. But in Africa and Latin America specifically, it seems to be doing quite well. One of the research managers at Canalis, Ben Stanton, he said that as it grows, it evolves. It is now transforming, and it's obviously Xiaomi. It's transforming its business model from challenger to incumbent with initiatives such as channel partner consolidation and more careful management of older stock in the open market. So I think we've kind of seen that evolution kind of happening in South Africa of late, not just with Xiaomi, but with Oppo and Vivo as well. Oppo perhaps more visibly. All three kind of brands have been available in South Africa for the past few months. Xiaomi probably the longest, but I think in recent months, we've seen the company kind of reaffirm its status within South Africa. This week, they also launched a series of new affordable mid-range and well-specced devices, the Redmi Note 10 series. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not they can retain their number two spot in, I guess, in next quarter. And kind of what moves the likes of Oppo and Vivo make, and as well as what kind of Huawei is going to be doing moving forward, because it looks as far as smartphone shipments go, it is really falling behind now. And I know that the company has outlined that software is kind of the focus moving forward. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this develops. And it looks like Samsung's crown is definitely what these three Chinese smartphone vendors are maybe aiming for. And who knows, we could potentially see Apple drop to number five in the next quarter, depending on what happens as far as its sales go. So yeah, a really interesting time when it comes to smartphone shipments across the world.
Robin, before we go on, sorry, Ben, and I don't mean to cut you off. I just want to ask because I might forget the question. Did this report mention the pandemic at all and how that may have affected buying habits?
So they don't make specific mention of the pandemic. They did, however, say that Samsung and Apple, because the average selling prices of their devices are a lot higher than those that Xiaomi and Vivo and Oppo are bringing into countries, that has played a factor. So it is, I guess, worthwhile noting that Samsung and Apple like to kind of use the year and book in their big releases. So you'll have your iPhones perhaps towards the end of this year, and Samsung like to do the Galaxy S's and then the Galaxy Notes kind of on either end of the year. So it is only Q2. I suspect that these numbers will probably be the same in Q3, but then Q4 probably you'll see the likes of Apple kind of have a bit of a resurgence when the new iPhones get released, and kind of that momentum will probably take them into Q1 of next year. So it's kind of a mix of really well-priced devices and almost the other larger manufacturers perhaps not having new devices on show at the moment.
So one day. So sorry, Brendan, go ahead.
So I do just want to touch on something. I don't think that whatever Apple presents in the next two quarters is going to be enough to bring it market share, based purely on the fact that looking at these trends, every single one of the brands that has made higher gains is offering phones that are cheaper. And I think that this is where the market is heading. I think we spoke about this earlier this year, regarding budget smartphones. And I think that that's where the market is shifting because, and I do think that the pandemic has had a bit of an effect on this because it, especially for me, it's made me kind of reassess where I spend my money and what I'm spending my money on. And I think that maybe this is a sentiment being felt around the world. And do you need a smartphone that costs $1,300? No, you don't. Especially when one that is half the price does exactly the same thing. So props to Xiaomi for, number one, taking the gap that Huawei left behind it and just going full hog into expanding their business. So props to them. But Samsung and Apple really need to do something drastic. And by drastic, I mean like these premium phones that you guys are shilling, you need to reconsider it. I'm not saying don't offer premium phones because there is definitely a market for it, but there needs to be a focus on like your A series. And I don't know what Apple's going to do. Apple's going to have to do something that's more budget friendly. And that just goes against everything that I know about Apple.
I have to wonder if Apple and Samsung have some really like big gun phones or tablets or whatever in the pipelines, but they haven't announced them or put them up for sale yet because of the pandemic. They probably want the pandemic to finish. or to be controlled, and they want people to get a bit more money, and then they'll be like, hey, we got this big stuff, we've been working on it for years, we didn't announce it because of X, Y, and Z. I have to wonder if that's a bit of their plan too.
I mean,
yeah, I think Samsung has a wider gamut, like we mentioned, the A series, and that kind of competes with what the Xiaomi and Vivo and Oppo bring into the country. But like Brendan said, Apple, all the mini iterations that they have of iPhones, those do not come cheap. So they're going to have to really think hard about how they kind of position themselves in terms of pricing and their devices moving forward, because I don't think that having Pros and Pro Maxes is really going to help them secure that number two spot again.
Sorry, I do want to move on, but I just want to add one more thing. This looks at purely shipments, doesn't it, Robin?
Yeah.
I have to wonder if, even though some companies might be low on the list, they probably made more money, because like with Apple, maybe they ship less units, but each unit has a bigger profit margin.
I mean,
so we also have to consider that.
Fair enough. But at the same time, I mean, if your market's only grown by 1%.
Yeah, 100%.
That's not good, especially when your competitors are gaining by 83% in the same quarter. You got to look at that and realize that you're doing something wrong.
Oh, no.
Anyway, all right. Let's move on to the meat and potatoes of this AfriCast. This week, there have been tensions throughout South Africa as looting, protests, and violence erupted last weekend. And it got us thinking when the – what do they call themselves? NatJoins – gave us a briefing earlier this week, and Minister of Police Becky Kelea said, we also issue a stern warning to those circulating inflammatory messages on various social media platforms which are aimed at exciting violence and disregard of the law. Any crime committed in the social media sphere where persons intentionally share and distribute inflammatory and information inciting violence messages anonymously is as good as a crime committed. As the cluster, we are monitoring all social media platforms, and we are tracking those who are sharing false information and calling for civil disobedience. So that seems rather innocuous. Government is looking at social media, but here on the African continent, African leaders have a bit of a habit of shutting down the internet when there is unrest within their nations. It's not something that's exclusive to Africa, of course. Looking at a report published by Access Now in March of this year, they give a breakdown of the number of internet shutdowns by country over 2020. So if we look over the African continent, most nations had one internet shutdown. And when I say most, I'm talking about Tanzania, Burundi, Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan, Chad, Egypt, Algeria, Mali, Togo, and Guinea, which had two internet shutdowns in 2020. But obviously, as I said, it's not something that's exclusive to Africa. India, for instance, had 109 internet shutdowns throughout 2020. The longest internet shutdown, however, was in Myanmar, where the government cut off internet throughout 2020 and 2021. I think they said it lasted for about 3 months at a time. So internet shutdowns are kind of common around the world when folks don't really like that what their citizens are doing. The reasons are obviously varied for why internet is shut down, but it got us a bit worried, or especially me, because in South Africa, we've never actually experienced a shutdown of the internet. And while I don't suspect that we will get to that point, I think it's important to know, number one, how the government can do it, and number two, if you can get around it and how to get around censorship, because it's very important to be able to have communication. Like, as I explained in a piece I wrote earlier this week, while the internet can be used for bad things, it can also be used for good things. I mean, citizens this week rallied to defend infrastructure, malls, their homes by using the internet, by creating chat groups and stuff like that so that you could coordinate and defend things, right? But that same thing can be done by bad actors. And it is scary to think about that government would, in order to address bad actors, shut down the internet for everybody. So we went on a bit of an exploratory trip and went around and looked for ways that the government would block the internet. So I spoke to Chief Executive Officer at CyberSec Clinique, Doreen Makwena, about how governments might be able to block the internet. And the first way that she mentioned was by blocking it at a DNS level. So your domain name server. Man, can't talk
about it. It's a hard one to say. No, it's a hard one to say.
So to get around that, or another way that they could do it is by using a proxy. So they would funnel all internet traffic through a proxy, and then you wouldn't be able to view SSL encrypted sites, meaning you'd have to install a certificate, and that certificate could be used to decrypt content that folks are viewing through that proxy. So there are a couple of ways it could be done. It is possible, is the crux of the matter here, right? Is that while you think that government doesn't have the capabilities, it does have the capabilities. So that was the first question. The next question I had is how to get around that. And I think that this is very important stuff to know. So in the event of a complete blackout, in terms of there is no internet coming in and out of the country, there's very little you can do, right? If you don't have a connection, you can't connect through something, if that makes any sort of sense. But if you have, if, for instance, government is trying to just block internet or trying to funnel internet around things, there are things you can do. So, for instance, the first one that pops to mind is a VPN, a virtual private network. But the issue with that, as Makwena pointed out to us, is that most VPNs use a standard port. Right. And if government starts blocking those ports, the VPN can open up another port, but then it becomes a game of cat and mouse. And because VPNs have so many servers, they might not update them. Right. So a VPN is a good way to start. Then something else you mentioned is a SOC S5 proxy, which you need to have a bit more knowledge about. And yeah, there's a link to the story that within the feature I wrote from NordVPN, which explains how to start up a SOX 5 proxy. But again, it's not something that just anybody can really do. Something that you did mention, which was really interesting to me, was satellite internet companies. So satellite internet companies don't actually have a breakout within the country, right? Their service is coming to you from the heavens. So you could, they could essentially not comply with the legislation, but obviously that runs the risk of getting into trouble with governments. But like, that's a really clever thing that I hadn't considered, was using a satellite internet company to get online and going through that way. Before we get to the other stuff, the other apps and other things that I recommend people using, do you guys have any questions, any thoughts, anything really?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about those internet blackouts that were done across Africa by the government. Was there a distinction between the internet being turned off completely and certain sites being blocked? Because I know in one of them, they just turned off Twitter, if I'm not mistaken. So I just want to know, in that report, do they make the distinction between those two things?
No, they don't. So it's difficult, because in some instances where you have, like, say in Nigeria, where they blocked Twitter, that does count as a shutdown, because you can't really access a certain services. But in general, the internet is still running. But this report looks at shutdowns in terms of things that you're not being able to access. So they don't make the distinction of whether the internet was shut down completely or whether it was only a partial shutdown. But yeah.
Because I could definitely see the South African government shutting down Twitter, but not the entire internet altogether.
You say that, but so I had this conversation with a few people throughout the week, and I mentioned that I was writing the story, and they're like, but that will never happen. And to a degree, I agree with them, because, I mean, a lot of South Africa's economy is now reliant on the internet. I mean, without the internet, we wouldn't be able to work. And that's not just for like private business. I think that goes for a lot of government business and stuff in the public sector as well. I mean, pretty sure that these organizations are using some form of Google services or Amazon Web Services or Azure or something like that. So I think that a total internet shutdown would quite literally cripple South Africa to a point, even if it was just for one day, to a point that would be, I don't even want to imagine trying to come back from something like that.
Yeah, and putting aside, I mean, it's probably unconstitutional in terms of free speech too. But, you know, I mean, the government could do anything. They could technically, you know, anything's a possibility. Yeah, I just thought it would be interesting to know the difference there because, you know, I was going to mention this later, but I'll mention it now. Even before now, if you went on South African Twitter and you looked at the trending keywords, not the trending tags, the keywords, right? There are always, every given day of the week, there are calls to violence. A lot of the times you can go on the local Twitter trending and the one that gets trended a lot is just the word foreigner. And if you go look in the trending things for foreigners, you see a lot of people saying, I don't want to repeat it, but there are calls to violence for foreigners saying they steal our jobs or whatever, which I don't even want to get into why that's so ridiculous and not true. But every day there's something like this on Twitter. And now they're only paying attention because there's riots. I can't tell you how many tweets I've reported to Twitter in my lifetime. There's so much casual calls to violence and racism and deplorable stuff on Twitter all the time that I can see them turning that Twitter off just because of that. And also because a lot of people are being critical of the government. And that I'm 100% for because... Again, it's all another conversation we won't get into, but their handling of a lot of the governance in, you know, in completeness is terrible. And people have been calling them out on Twitter, but they might see the violence as a chance to say, oh, we banned Twitter in South Africa. We don't want to read this anymore. And they'll frame it as saying, oh, it's because people are calling for violence in the country.
Yeah. Robin, thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think we ever have a fully fledged shutdown or a government issued shutdown.
Yeah.
Given the state of our power utility, I wouldn't be surprised if something like that is more likely to happen, where simply the networks are just down because Eskom is down. I guess I have a little bit more optimism in the democracy of our government, and I don't think anything that's happening like Myanmar would ever happen here, or perhaps what's happening in Eswatini earlier this month would happen here. That said, I was kind of interested to hear that the one point about internet satellite companies. So would something like Starlink kind of fall under that? And if so, given that Starlink requires regulatory approval from local agencies, does that mean that they still have control? Can they be shut down then in that respect?
Well, you see, that's an interesting thing to bring up because I don't actually know how it works in South Africa. Like, for instance, we saw a lot of reports regarding Starlink having to register in South Africa and be BBE compliant. But in terms of, because there are already satellite companies operating in South Africa, for instance, Eutelsat is one of them. And I'm 90% sure that they would have to go through the registration process of listing or registering to do business in South Africa because, well, you have to do that to do business in South Africa, right? But when it comes to a blackout, that would be interesting to see because government would have to stipulate that if you have a, like, let's say, for instance, right, that MTN, which operates throughout Africa, has a whole bunch of different pipelines that it needs to maintain, or it might have points of presence that are referring to servers in South Africa and other countries. So there would need to be a stipulation from government within legislation and through a gazette saying that internet service providers need to cut off their internet access from this specific place. And if that applies to a satellite company, they would obviously have to comply. Otherwise, they might risk losing their business or being slapped with a fine or both. So it would all depend on how governments implement it, I think, and how things are worded. Like we saw, for instance, last year with the lockdown regulations, things like... or in the early days of the lockdown, right? Folks didn't the legislation didn't make it clear that you weren't allowed to do things like sell a cooked chicken from Woolies. And only after folks had realized that this was happening, or authorities realized this is happening, did they go and clarify. So I would think that this would be something similar, where you would have to look at what the Gazette says when government does, if it does decide to cut off the internet, there would have to be a Gazette to showcase how that is being done. And within that Gazette, I think it would detail how the internet must be shut down from internet service providers. But because satellite internet isn't like traditional internet, whereas you need to have an exchange, which then goes to X, that goes to Y, because everything's in the sky and it's just beaming the signal down to you. I think it might be a bit tricky to legislate around that. That's why it was mentioned, and I thought that it was a cool idea. But yeah, there's no guarantees, obviously.
Yeah, it does concern me, though. Like, we've already kind of seen with the state of disaster how things can be quickly gazetted and we have to react.
Yeah.
So yeah, that does concern me a little bit. But you were saying, Kurt?
You guys think, and this is just opinion now, do you guys think if they turned off Twitter tomorrow that there would be any less violence?
No, there would be more.
Yeah, I'm kind of asking a question because I already have an answer in mind. I honestly think that if they turned off anything, it would be seen as an act of suppression and it would cause more violence than stopping it at all. And again, we want to just put out that these are just hypotheticals. The government, as far as I know, has not talked about banning anything, right?
Yeah.
You, Robin, do you think it would cause less or more violence?
It depends on the service. So something like Twitter, I think that might... I don't think if Facebook, for example, was shut down, I think that's a problem. That said, if something like WhatsApp was shut down, that might be a problem. I think it depends on the platform and kind of what is communicated on there. I'm sure Facebook is used for organizing and coordinating, but I think the immediacy of something like Twitter and WhatsApp makes it a bit more important in those respects.
100%.
So I just want to run over some applications and just some things that I recommend you do just in case you wake up tomorrow and certain websites can't be accessed, or, you know, anything can happen at any time. As the Boy Scouts say, be prepared. So there are a couple of things that I do just want to point out that you should do. The first thing I want to recommend is that you download Tor, or the Onion Router. This is a... Okay, so Tor generally is associated with the dark web because it is the way that you access the dark web, but it's associated with the dark web because of what it does. So it essentially anonymizes you on the internet, but it's a bit more complicated than just you open Tor and all of a sudden you're anonymous on the internet, right? There's a wonderful video from Computerphile that explains how Tor works and how you should use it. So if you download Tor, you're going to get a page after you download it that tells you how you should use it. I would recommend you go to the FAQ and you learn and you read up about how best to use Tor, because there are things that you shouldn't do. For instance, right now I have a browser screen open full screen on my desktop. So anybody that sees what I am doing online knows that I have a computer monitor that is full HD resolution, right? And while that information on its own isn't necessarily dangerous or risky to have out there, when it's paired with other information that can identify you, like your IP address, what websites you frequent, then it becomes easy to build a profile around you. So there are certain things that you need to do when you use Tor, essentially breaking all the bad habits that you've acquired from using the internet for all these years. So Tor is definitely something I recommend folks use. If you use Brave browser, it comes with a Tor extension. When you browse in private mode, you have to enable it. However, I would still recommend going and downloading the official Tor browser, which is based off of Firefox, if I believe. It's still a Chromium-based browser. But yeah, and then maybe play around in it. See what sort of search engines you can use, though we don't recommend using search engines with Tor. Kind of gives you away. So yeah, just play around with it. Write down some onion addresses that you think are important. I know Facebook has a dark web or onion website that you can use, though once again, probably not best to use it because then people can see where you're coming from. So yeah, Tor. Have either of you used the Onion Rita before, Robin?
No, I haven't. I'd have to defer to you on that.
Okay, Clinton?
I haven't either, but I do have a Nord account, and I think you can do Onion through that. I'm just got it open on my phone. I'm just trying to find it.
You can do Onion routing through over VPN with NordVPN.
Yeah, so that's also an option. I think other VPN services offer it too. I just thought I'd bring that up, but I haven't actually done it, no.
So speaking of VPNs, that's the other thing that you should have. Now, this is tricky to recommend because we can recommend that you use a free VPN, but I personally would not recommend that, mainly because the limitations that are granted to free VPNs are quite restrictive. For instance, Kaspersky offers VPN secure connection and there's a free tier, but you can only access 200 megabytes of data through that free VPN and then it stops working. So I don't really recommend using a free VPN. And the other reason I don't recommend that is because you get what you pay for, right? If you are paying a company, and I'll go through three that I would recommend. If you're paying a company, there's kind of this accountability to fall back on, right? Places like ExpressVPN, Surfshark, NordVPN, these are reputable companies that aren't just going to take your money and run, but that it's their business to ensure that their VPNs work properly. So I've used NordVPN many times. I've played around with ExpressVPN. I'm not a big fan of their UI, but that's just a personal thing. Surfshark, I've heard very good things about. I haven't played with it myself, but it comes recommended from other folks that I trust. So I recommend spending a bit of money on a VPN. You can use it for more than just getting around possible internet blocks. You can use it to get around geo restrictions of content, even though I'm definitely not telling you to do that. That's a bad thing. Don't get around geo restrictions of content. It's bad. Definitely don't do it.
Wink, wink.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. If you're listening, Netflix, I'm not winking or nudging. So it's just nice to have, especially for things like, Clinton, you had an issue with the internet a few years back and you were able to get around that by using a VPN, correct?
That was the cable break. That happened. Jeez, that was like a 2 months of problems with that.
That was last year, actually. Now that I think about it, 2020.
Was it? I'm not exactly sure why, but with some sites would either not load or they would take ages to load. But then if I did it through a VPN, they would load as fast as nothing was happening. Now, I might be showing my ignorance when it comes to internet connections, but I'm not 100% sure why that is. Maybe it has something to do with the routing or the way NordVPN handles it, or my ISP or the fiber provider. I'm sorry, I can't provide an explanation of why that happened. But if you're having problems with your internet, your VPN is just like another tool in your toolbox where you might as well give it a try and see if it works. And in that situation, it did work. And it was so helpful for those that month or so that we had internet problems that I could just turn on my VPN and browse as normal.
Yeah, so there's definitely benefits to having a VPN. I know a lot of people will talk about that it stops spies from seeing what you're doing when you're in coffee shops. I'm not going to feed you that line because I don't necessarily agree with it. You still need to practice good cybersecurity hygiene, ensure that your passwords are safe, don't browse sensitive stuff on public Wi-Fi. Yeah, but I think a VPN is a good thing for anybody who spends a lot of time on the internet, is a good thing to have. Then I'm going to recommend something else, and that is downloading Signal. So we've spoken about WhatsApp and Telegram and all that sort of stuff, and for once, I'm going to make a recommendation without saying, oh, but you know, I recommend downloading Signal because it is by far the most secure and less hungry of the applications. When I say less hungry, I mean less hungry for your personal data. So Signal only requires your phone number to register, and that's it. You can then start doing whatever you want. You can set messages to delete within like 5 seconds of sending them. You can do calls. You can do video calls. It's basically on par in terms of the basic functionality of WhatsApp and Telegram, but it's a lot more secure. Hell, WhatsApp uses a protocol called Signal to encrypt its messages, which comes from Signal. So I recommend using Signal because encryption is enabled by end-to-end encryption is enabled by default, and I feel a lot better using it with the few folks that I have on Signal. So use that, especially for messaging. Two more applications that are worth taking a look at if you are a bit more of a tech-savvy person. The first one is called Lantern. So Lantern is it's sort of like a VPN, but not really. It's called a circumvention app. So essentially what this allows you to do is it allows you to get around blocks to websites, and it's completely free. So you don't need to use a VPN. They do recommend that you use it with a VPN if you are worried about being seen. But if you just want to access websites that are not accessible in your country, you can use something like Lantern. The other one is called Siphon, but P with a P at the beginning, so it's P Siphon. Man, did I just say that out loud?
Who names these internet things? It's always dumb.
Siphon.
It's a hell of a thing to siphon.
Yeah, okay, all right. Everybody have a laugh? Everybody got their laugh out of the way? Good, okay. So Siphon uses a VPN SSH and HTTP proxy to provide you uncensored access to internet content. I've used it a little bit this week just to give it a test, and it works pretty well. It's not as good as a VPN, but it's not trying to be a VPN. It's just trying to get you around blocks on the internet. But once again, these require a bit more tech-savvy knowledge, and I would recommend going and reading the FAQs for both of these. I've linked both of them in the stories that we've written this week. So those are our recommendations for things to do. And then just general privacy measures, right? Be careful about how you do things. I mentioned don't make Windows full screen. Don't access things like Facebook through a VPN. Things like that where these the sites are actually taking the data and seeing who you are. Like if you're using a VPN and you're logging into AmazonPrime.com, they're going to see, or Amazon.com, they're going to see that Brendan is all of a sudden logging in from a weird URL. He must be using a VPN, right? So just be cognizant about how you use these things. And read through the documentation that these applications come with, because they contain a lot of pertinent information that you should be paying attention to. Is there anything on that list that you guys have used before? Anything else that you'd recommend? Robin, start with you.
So I wasn't a big VPN guy, but in 2019, I can't remember, the past 18 months have been terrible. I think in 2019, I went to Beijing for a tech event. And I needed to get around some of the restrictions there in China. And I used ExpressVPN. Like you mentioned, the UI isn't the greatest, but it is quite simple. And I was able to continue working as a result of that. So yeah, that's one I can recommend. If someone just wants something, I guess, simple and easy to use, it should get the job done.
Clinton?
Like I mentioned, I've been using NordVPN. I don't know if I'm going insane or it's something with my internet, but I felt like their service has gotten slower over the years. I've been using them for like 2 years now, but that's completely anecdotal. The real thing I want to mention is that, like Brendan said, you should probably use a paid version and not any free version of NordVPN or anything else. But the thing is, they're always doing specials where you can get a few years for like 50% off or something like that. And they're always advertising on YouTube, ExpressVPN as well. So it is expensive when you look at the base prices, but it's one of those things where the base price is almost never what you actually pay. So just look around. If you watch a lot of YouTube, you know, just watch a few more videos. You'll find someone having like a code to get a discount, and you really should use it. Again, like I said, it's not just for privacy and all this stuff. It's just another tool in your toolbox if you need to fix something with your connection for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So yeah. Avoid the free stuff. You can probably get the good stuff for much less than the actual sticker price. You just got to find a YouTuber who has a discount code.
Yeah. Once again, I do just want to reiterate that there is not a censorship looming in South Africa. This is more just being prepared and knowing what to expect, because the last thing you want is to wake up one morning and you have no way of getting online and finding out what is going on. And while a couple of years ago that might not have sounded as dreadful, just saying the words out loud, waking up and not being able to know what is going on around the world gives me anxiety. So prepare yourself just in case it does happen. I'm not saying that it is going to happen, but just in case, you know, like Clinton said, this is just another tool in your toolbox that you can lean on for anything, really. And whether if you end up only ever using your VPN to watch that one show that's not available in South Africa, I think it will be worth it. And yeah, just be safe, be cognizant of how you're using the internet while you're using these services. And yeah, just be prepared, folks. Be prepared.
Yeah. Just think about the last time something happened where you lost electricity or something happened with your ISP and you didn't have your internet for a few hours, how terrible it was. Now imagine that for a few days or weeks or months.
And at the behest of government.
Yeah, so try to be preventative in there.
And keep an eye out, right? If you see government starting to talk about stuff, get involved. I think that was one of the most important points that Doreen Makwena raised from CyberSecurity. She said, citizens must actively participate in internet governance-related initiatives. Issues like censorship and internet shutdown should be strongly prohibited as they fuel human rights violations. I think that's the most important point, is when you see something that you disagree with, say something about it. And I don't mean hop onto Twitter and crow about it. I mean, go through the processes that are there for public participation in government-related things, right? When e-tolls happened, I think there was a story that a total of 90 people came to voice their concern about e-tolls. And where do we sit? We sit with e-tolls. So if you see things, get involved. Be an active citizen and comment on things when they're open. I know when the gun laws were being debated and there was talk about draft, citizens became hugely active in regards to that and commented on that in droves. And I'd like to see the same thing for internet-related and communication-related legislation in the country. So definitely be more involved. Keep an eye out. Keep reading websites like ours, because we do highlight these things when they pop up. So just be an active citizen, folks, and be safe out there. I think that's going to wrap it up from us for this week. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. Hopefully the next week is a little bit calmer, and the vaccine rollout leaps forward thanks to more citizens being able to get their jab. From myself, Brendan Lotz, cheerio from Clinton Matos.
Hi, everybody. Somebody give me the jab. I need it.
And from Robin DiCetti.
Take care, everyone.
We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Cheers.
We're sorry. The number you have dialed is not in service at this time.